Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 74. It's August 11th, 2020. Few knew the resonances of the performative Texan in the 1970s, as did Edwin Bud Schrake. A friend, associate, or acquaintance of such Lone Star notables as Billy Lee Brammer, Gary Cartwright, Willie Nelson, Ann Richards, and Jack Ruby, Schrake's journalism for Sports Illustrated, Harper's, and Texas Monthly placed him in fitting situations from which to recount the changing cultural politics of his time. In one such instance, in the spring of 1967, Muhammad Ali had flown to Houston to refuse induction into the armed forces, and as he often did when he came to Texas, requested that Schrake pick him up at the airport. Schrake rented a Cadillac convertible for the occasion, thinking a leisurely open-air drive through the streets of Houston would do Ali good. Instead, Ali immediately urged Schrake to take him, quote, where the trouble was, that is, to the site of ongoing protests over police brutality racking their traditionally black Texas Southern University in the city's Third Ward. Their protesters reacted wildly to Ali, but the nationalist spirit on campus also meant that the Anglo-Texan Schrake came in for verbal abuse as he tried to drive the Cadillac into the heart of the protest. Finally, Ali got up, stood on the car, and shouted to the assembled, "Leave this honky alone. He is my personal chauffeur." The rest of the afternoon passed without incident, and Schrake had gained a glimpse of a new racial politics, a reordering of traditional notions of authority, identity, race, and nation, that while perhaps not so total as Ali voiced it, made for a changing cultural and political landscape in Texas in which non-white voices spoke back to Anglo power. That's one paragraph very early in Jason Mellard's Progressive Country, how the 1970s transformed the Texan in popular culture as he's setting up the sweep of his entire argument and tale. It's interesting, as I've just begun reading into the very recent history of the recently departed Edwin Bud Schrake, knowing very little, have seen his name for decades as a co-author with Harvey Pinnock of those golf books and just floating around in Texas, but certainly being no expert on him. We had one story, I think last week, recently, where he's out in East Texas, talking about the environment in East Texas and interacting with East Texans, but with long hair, more or less a hippie, and being sort of knocked around or dismissed at a minimum by individuals in East Texas. And all he needed to do then was get to his car, grab a cowboy hat, tuck in his hair, and he could get along just fine. Here he is with Ali driving a Cadillac into a protest in Houston, and I think it said 67. And we read just yesterday Ecclesiastes 1 and the very famous opening paragraph of A Tale of Two Cities, and was struck by, again, the more things change, the more they stay the same, and there's nothing new under the sun. Everything that's happening now has happened before. All that you're going through now, others will go through it in the future, and they won't remember you just as you don't remember those in the past. And it's very true, we're grappling with not knowing giant, critical, significant, tremendous rivers of history. We also don't know some of the more recent, just tributaries. We don't know. We just simply don't know. We lose track. There's another great book of Texas cultural history by another scholar, Texan scholar, named Stephen L. Davis. I believe both these individuals, I'll go check. Maybe it'll appear in the show notes at regular.fm/774. I believe both these individuals are at Texas State. Maybe helping or helped by the Whitliff collections. That's a whole reservoir unto itself. Talking Cormac McCarthy and John Graves and Willie and Jerry Jeff and tons of magic down there. I'm just going to read a short bit. It sets up the piece. And Stephen Davis has given a paragraph each in the intro to some of the writers he's going to talk about. King and Cartwright and some of these folks. And here's his bit on Edwin Budd Shrake is viewed by his peers and a small circle of critics as one of the most accomplished novelists Texas has produced. Yet his fiction has not sold well, and he's largely made his living over the years as a sports writer, screenwriter, and biographer. He joined his pal Dan Jenkins at Sports Illustrated in the 1960s and 1970s. He turned to Hollywood in the 1980s, and he collaborated with Willie Nelson on the singer's autobiography. In the 1990s, he co-wrote Harvey Pinnock's Little Red Book, which became the best-selling sports book ever. Though nearly unknown as a novelist, Shrake has produced two books that rank among America's finest since World War II. His 1968 historical novel, Blessed McGill, a deeply humorous and spiritually resonant work, is the first absurdist Western and one of the most original and powerful novels to emerge from the American Southwest. In 1972, Shrake published Strange Peaches, a searing portrait of Dallas in the days leading up to the Kennedy assassination. The 60s gave rise to excellent music, journalism, and film, but relatively few great novels were written of the era. Bud Shrake's Strange Peaches, though largely overlooked, is among them. And Davis continues, for much of the 20th century, Texas was a mostly inhospitable place for literary artists. There were few presses, no major publishers, and only scattered readers. Young writers felt trapped by the state's confines and found it necessary to leave in order to make their way in the larger world. From the 1920s to the 1950s, Texas letters were dominated by a single voice, J. Frank Dobie, who often seemed more at home around the campfire than in front of a typewriter. Along with his compadres, historian Walter Prescott Webb and naturalist Roy Bedichek, Dobie formed the state's first literary cluster, the Texas Triumvirate. The group's tales of Texas Rangers, buried treasure, bear hunters, coyotes, and longhorns kept alive a sense of Texas' rural mythic past. But their work was far removed from the currents of modern American literature. Shrake, King, Brammer, Cartwright, and Jenkins grew up aware of Dobie and Webb, but the old-timers' emphasis on the past did not resemble the Texas they knew, a land of fast-growing cities and hard-edged political issues. Their own literary influences became Mark Twain, Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and the Beat Generation. For these emerging hipsters, the choices were clear during years of political and social upheaval. Generations of Jim Crow laws were coming under attack. A conservative state government was challenged by liberal activists. An undeclared war in Vietnam seemed to defy America's basic principles. Discredited, objective reporting was replaced by a new journalism, and notions of normalcy were upended by drugs that provided new ways of perceiving the world. The literary outlaws chronicled with daring, wit, and sophistication the state's culture during a time of rapid social change. In long-standing, versatile careers, they have produced journalism, fiction, dramas, biographies, and screenplays. They helped Texans attain a new awareness of their state. Taken as a whole, their work establishes an authentic Texas vision, one far removed from the fanciful notions promulgated by outsiders and the state's dewy-eyed sentimentalists. Yet much of their work also represents, as one critic observed, a last-ditch stand for what has come to be called male chauvinism. As full-time writers unconnected to any university, this group showed for the first time that professional writers could survive in Texas, though the living was not always easy. They helped develop Austin as the state's artistic hub, and they beat a path to Hollywood for others to follow. They changed the state's language and its literary climate. They've recovered from years of drug and alcohol abuse, and their attitudes towards women have largely evolved. Now, as active and engaged writers in their 70s, they continue to provide inspiration. What follows is one version of their story. And this book is called Texas Literary Outlaws, Six Writers in the 60s and Beyond. And it sure does seem great. I looked at Shrake in the index and he said, you know, he's a fifth of the book or something. Just because he's a sixth of the book. He's one of these heavily featured guys. But here again, we have some of these elements that seem common. Certainly overlap with Willie and Waylon. They're getting... It's funny. They went away. Nashville, New York. Willie and Shrake. And they come back to Texas. And Texas is changing. Texas is dealing with social issues at the time. They're sort of old, classic, rural, western Texas. Oil business, Texas. And there's all this new stuff happening. And the cities that are just exploding. And all this massive growth. That's been the story of the whole place my entire lifetime. And probably will be for a couple more lifetimes. Just massive, massive amounts of people streaming in. And it's interesting, these figures are all competing, record upon record or book upon book, in the release schedule. Of an age like myself and any of y'all that are around my age, like, all these books are written before we're aware. These records are basically out before we're really aware. So we can't piece it together again as the conversation was evolving and how they were coming out one after the other. But it's fascinating to go back and think about them. I have never, ever read any of Shrake's fiction. It was news to me. I do associate him as a sports writer. I also associate him as a sports writer who got a lot of deeper, wider, non-sports pieces in publications like Sports Illustrated. So he must have been an interesting individual, hell of a creative force. And I'm going to go back and find and read some of those in addition. But I really do, of course, want to read those two novels of his. And I can list in my mind a whole bunch of nonfiction writers, big ones, who live in Texas, work from Texas. It's harder on the fiction side. I'm sure they're there. I just don't have a big list. There have been some wildly successful nonfiction people across all the different domains inside nonfiction here in the state. I'd like to get to know more about what's going on in Texas fiction. I guess Larry McMurtry is obvious and a giant. And you may, by the way, I can speak a little bit to Larry McMurtry. Certainly more than Buttrake. I know nothing of his fiction. I've read maybe a third or half of what McMurtry's written, something like that. And the westerns, the old stuff, is great. It's great. But his contemporary stuff is also wonderful. He's got a book. I think I read some Ken Whistle first. And then there's one that, I don't know if it came out later. It might have come out before. But the characters connect, and it's called All My Friends Are Going to Be Strangers. Really great. And so there is literature in Texas. I will find, by the way, in one of these books, McMurtry, there's some line that's related to McMurtry having a really great criticism or sting of Austin. It kind of really nails Austin in a great way. Kind of busts our chops. So I wanted to stick to a little more of this history. I've been thinking about it, and hopefully you can tell too. I've been thinking about the city of Austin. All these cities in the U.S. right now are going through huge, huge upheavals. Tons of stuff's being put on the table. COVID and politics and everything's sort of, we're in a state of disequilibrium that we haven't had in quite a while, it seems. Especially one where there's not like a major war going on and military action. And so there's all the atmosphere is charged and, you know, changing. And it is reminiscent. It is interesting to read about these individuals. One generational click back who were going through this in the late 60s into the 70s. And how they tackled things, where they went. And, of course, we're all living very much in the roots that are coming up in the ground that they tilled, if you will. Or we're under the shade of the trees that they planted, if you want. For sure. These are, a lot of these people are still with us. Eddie Wilson is still here. Shrake is not. A lot of Eddie's buddies are not. Mike Tonneson is still here. Bobby Hederman, I believe, who's mentioned in all over the Armadillo story, still here with us. A lot of these folks are, but not all of them are. Right now, I believe, I heard, I'm not in my truck very much these days, but I was driving around listening to KUTX, and they're doing a big 50th anniversary retrospective of the Armadillo. And it's fascinating too, isn't it, that Shrake's gone off to New York, come back, I believe, and he gives Eddie $1,000 to go make this venue happen because the Vulcan is closed. The place of Chase Don Hyde out of town. And also in the tale, I can't remember if I read that portion or not, but they loved the Armadillo as a symbol. They loved it at the Vulcan Gas Company too. And some of those artists found, you know, came over to the Armadillo. And Eddie wanted to call it, I think, the Armadillo National Headquarters. And it was Shrake who suggested calling it the Armadillo World Headquarters. And that tiny little change. And their vision for what they were trying to do, people associate it with a music venue, as we should. That's, it galvanized so much for Austin. But they were doing so many other things there, hosting makers and ballet and politics, and is a cultural center, and it's inspiring. There is a great profile written by Brad Buchholz for The Statesman about Hank Ulrich. Eddie left the Armadillo. The Armadillo was open from 1970 to 1980, and Eddie left the day-to-day in 76, and Hank Ulrich ran it from that point. Eddie had a bar off of Sabine between 6th and 7th called The Raw Deal for a while. Then in the late 70s, just a little dive bar. And Hank Ulrich was running the Armadillo. And a really beautiful part of the story is he decided, or he just declared, we're going to show that hippies can be responsible. This is going to be a profitable venture. We're going to pay employees. We're going to pay our rent. And he succeeded in that vision. It wasn't a business that failed because it couldn't pay its bills. It was closed because the site was sold to become something else. They just lost their place. Fascinating stuff. Enough for today, hopefully, and I hope you all are great, and I'll talk with you tomorrow.